Okay, off and running for the final round. So I want to talk in this last talk about the work of contemplation. And I know that that language seems probably awkward to you, because for most of us, we've had it well rammed into our head that contemplation is a gift, and that it's specifically not a work, and that it can only be given. But unfortunately, the author of The Cloud of Unknowing, writing two centuries before that distinction got made, was blissfully unaware that it was not politically correct to call contemplation a work, and a work is what he called it. Over and over, he refers over, if you would do this work, if you would do this work, it was do this work. It was only in a later era of theology in which the real issue was, can you use techniques to acquire grace? Did this question of whether contemplation was a grace or a work even rise? But that question hadn't been raised at this time. And for him, it was manifestly evident that it was a work, and that the work that he saw was the stabilization of our awareness, of our mind, in this new kind of operating system that wasn't constantly running out and getting tangled up with objects of devotion, objects of imagination, no matter how pious and faithful, that we weren't doing that, but that we were learning to stabilize this capacity to meet and interabide and dwell in the divine life within the cloud of unknowing. This was the work, and the manual he's written, The Cloud of Unknowing, is really for those who feel called to this work of contemplation. So what he says over and over, and what his whole writing presumes, and this is very important to realize, is that he's writing to a younger monk or aspirant who has already presumably been well-formed and well-grounded in the cataphatic disciplines of the church. Then, in other words, he's already learned to do basic devotion, basic examination of consciousness, basic visualization and emotional identification with the wounds of Christ, with the sorrows of Mary. In other words, he's someone who's already been well formed in the Christian cataphatic devotional tradition. He's not proposing the work of contemplation as an end run around all that kind of stuff because it doesn't appeal to you. He sees it very strongly as the necessary preparation, and even says that without such a preparation, you're not going to get anywhere with contemplation. So it's really important to understand right from the start that this is where he's coming from. So I want to really look at what he has to say on the work of contemplation this while, and particularly in terms of how he develops the work of contemplation in a way that we would now probably recognize as, oh, he's really talking about levels of consciousness. And as I said before the break, that I think that that the cloud of unknowing is virtually universally misclassified in our history of Western spirituality, in our history of Western mysticism, that it's classified as a specimen of Western medieval and even monastic love mysticism because of the statement primarily that God can be known and held fast by love, but by thought, never. And in my talk this morning, I tried to outline for you my sense that love has a much more specific meaning than what we would generally think we all mean by love. That the author of The Cloud is not talking about love in the sense of affection or sentimentality or ardor or emotion. He's talking about love as a mode of perception, a holographic mode of perception, which aligns with the whole and perceives it by sympathetic resonance, feelingfulness grounded in the heart. And so when you say that God is held fast by love, he is indeed saying that, but what he means by love is not what we think he means by love, okay? So anyway, I think if I had to explore and say in a nutshell what I think the cloud of unknowing is and why it is of such singular importance, it's the first and earliest effort, map of a typology of consciousness to exist in the Western tradition, clearly acknowledging levels of consciousness. He doesn't use the word consciousness, but we're going to see that that's exactly what he's talking about, with contemplation associated as a level that I think nowadays would pass muster quite readily as unitive or non-dual. So we have here, hidden in the pages of this alleged masterpiece of Christian love mysticism, probably the earliest schematic of levels of consciousness known in the West. And it goes sailing right by nearly everybody because they're not looking for it. It really is astounding, and when we see what he has to say, it's so fresh and so original and I think so completely timely and useful, also personally and practically useful, that I think it becomes important for us to study it more and to use it more wisely. So the chapter in question is the chapter 8. And before I sort of dig into it in chapter and verse, I'm assuming that most of you, being sort of intelligent citizens of the 21st century, have bumped into many of the modern maps of the levels of consciousness. They're all over everywhere. The whole idea of beginning to look at levels of consciousness really got rolling in the second half of the 20th century with the work of a fellow named Gebser, Jean Gebser, and then got popularized by Ken Wilber in his book, Up From Even. You can't have done Thomas Keating's work on the human condition without bumping into levels of consciousness, because he directly borrows this from Ken Wilber. Remember how he talks about the magical level of consciousness and then the mythic membership level of consciousness, which is the mythic membership is very, very bonded with and identified with the values of tribe, of your immediate troop, of your immediate peer group or identity group. Beyond that is the rational level of consciousness. This all coming back from, you know, when you read Thomas's work. And then above that, you begin to get verge towards those non-dual states. Above the rational, and Ken Wilber has really developed this in some degrees much more detail than Thomas, above the rational level you get the pluralistic level. And that's kind of the dividing line in modern consciousness for a while between the ones who are on the more conservative and classic and intellectual sides of value systems in our country, and the ones that are all part of that progressive coexist, universal, progressive wave. It is often dancing around an orange-green level of consciousness. Above that is the beginning of the gradations into the non-dual states. So that's the map. Thomas was very, very influenced with that. I can remember I was just arriving at Snowmass about the time that Thomas was all on and about Kim's book, Up From Eden. And Up From Eden really is the laying out of the levels of consciousness. This map is very, very current today, and Thomas Keating and Ken Wilber continue to be in close contact and, you know, kind of spark each other. So as Ken refines his map, Thomas refines his understandings of centering prayer and his presentations of it. And meanwhile, the whole thing has been popularized by another compatible tract in Don Beck's Spiral Dynamics that some of you may have heard of, that's being used to great advantage today to look at things like organizational evolution and many, many ways of how do we apply, how do we realize that in a culture such as ours, in a world in rapid transition, that people, just because we're all rational human beings, theoretically, we actually are responding and seeing the world from very, very different sets of perceptual lenses, which are actually on an evolutionary curve. And the teaching that Ken Wilber developed and went so powerfully and strongly with is that the human race as a whole has gone through over about at least a 10,000 year history, these stages in a gradual growth towards consciousness, and they're individually recapitulated in the life of each individual. So in other words, and you can perhaps see this more easily that way, you know, when you have a little baby, they're, you know, that for a while the baby can't even distinguish where the baby starts and you end if you're the mama. It's all still an extension of the womb. And then sometime at about 7 months old, they say, the baby gets the idea of, mama's different from me. And that I have to do things to get mama's attention when I'm hungry. And then it goes on with that, and the early stages of consciousness filling in for kids tend to be magical. You know, just like the early stages of primitive people, where there's the world is totemistic, there's boogeymen under the bed, the sun is a personage, the dolls and rocks have spirits. It's that whole word, and it's a world that's manipulated by incantation and prayer and sacrifice and ritual. Then beyond that comes the really, really intense primal bonding, you know, the sort of peer group thing that happens to kids when they get sort of like second, third, fourth grade. They get in their tribe, and then that kind of gives way. Sometimes growth and development stops right there. There are a lot of pundits that say that that's the level at which the vast majority of American society is now playing out. But beyond that is the rational, where you begin to stop thinking in corporate blocks and tribal security, but in individual responsibility and potential. And most of our great culture and our religious traditions grew up right on the cusp of the movement into that kind of consciousness. And then growing from there is more and more of a sense of coming back to oneness again, but it's no longer the kind of tribal, exclusionary mythic membership one, so much as intimations of the mystical body of Christ, that the human race is really one family, and that is till we can begin to organize and behave as a single unit, that we're just going to tear each other apart. So that kind of consciousness is dawning in us. Many would say that Jesus came to announce that consciousness and model it to the West for the very first time. And then beyond that, the great stages of non-duality that not only see oneness as a distant possibility, like if you pile up all the little pixels and put them in a pattern and you get oneness. But see the oneness first. See the whole first. And within it, see each part arranged in the wholeness. So at the non-dual levels, you begin to develop the capacity to think not from the part to the whole, but from the whole to the part. Sort of like looking at those dot matrix pictures and all of a sudden seeing the tulip in them. You see from the whole and you see what's contained within it. So the whole proposition is that consciousness has been evolving over the eons, something that not everybody would agree with, but the basic trend of the mainstream of the current and modern evolutionary thought seems to say, yeah, this is happening. And we're developing more and more of a capacity to think from that whole, from the part, to reconfigure ourselves as a global species rather than as individual or even national tribes. And that spiritual practice has a lot to do with this. So that's what maps and levels of consciousness are all about. Most of the languaging around this and most of the classic maps have been provided via the Eastern spiritual traditions. And folks say, well, there's no such comparable thing in the Western tradition. And well, so you say, well, you have the purgative unitive and or illuminative and unitive ways, but they are not so much levels of consciousness as deepening intensities of union. It's a whole different ballpark. So anyway, with that, we're going to look at Cloud Chapter 8 to see what this this 14th century Carthusian, presumably monk, has to do to say with levels of consciousness in which contemplation occupies perhaps the highest rung as his intimation of what non-dual perception, as we would call it today, looks like. So the chapter starts out in a rather different place. He's raising the question, and I'm sure it's a question that's been hovering around with all of you today. It's one of the biggies that's whenever you sit down to do centering prayer, it's back to those insights and illuminations again. If you've just received a perfectly good insight, why give it up? Why are you told to let it go? Why don't you hang on to it and run with it? And I'm sure that almost everybody in the room has at some point or another felt a certain twinge of regret in your centering prayer when this really beautiful insight has come and you know that what you have to do is let it go and you're not so sure it'll be back. So he's starting with that question. The question, as he frames it, is, well, why does he, as this monk giving the advice, why is he advising the younger monk that if you want to really do the work of contemplation, you have to give up the old spiritual practices that have carried you thus far? You have to cease your meditations, your contemplative devotions, all that kind of stuff, that the traditional cataphatic disciplines of the church. And he is very keen in saying that if you want to do the work of contemplation, you have to give them up, at least for some time. And so the question is, why? If they've done you so much good, why do you give them back up? Why aren't they specifically relevant to your time of contemplation? And so he sets out to ask that question. And you've got it, it's number 5 on your yellow sheet. This comes right out of the Cloud chapter 8. And where you ask me why you shall put it, the thought, down beneath the cloud of forgetting, since it is good in its nature when it is well used, and does you so much good and increases your devotion so much, to this I answer and say to you. And then he goes off and begins to unfold his schematic. And the schematic is pretty interesting to begin with. To this I say to you, there are two kinds of lives in Holy Church. One is the active life, and the other is the contemplative life. Well, so far this doesn't sound like rocket science. You've probably heard that dichotomy most of your days. So he said, he's just saying there's active life and contemplative life again. But then he goes on to say, the active is the lower and the contemplative is the higher. Again, this sounds familiar from what we're used to, right? The contemplative tends to get prejudiced over the active into people's valuations, right? To the great regret of activists. And then he goes on, the active life. Now begin to look at this map. See if you can envision it in your mind. And if you're sitting at the table with a blank piece of paper in front of you and a pen in your hand, you might even want to try and draw it. Because he's going to set you up an interesting schematic. He says the active life has 2 degrees, a higher and a lower. And the contemplative life also has 2 degrees, a lower and a higher. So now he's taken this twofold dichotomy and turned it into a fourfold map. So you've got, starting from the bottom, lower active, higher active, lower contemplative, higher contemplative, right? You with me so far? Draw it out if you're not. And then he goes this way. And these two lives are coupled together in such a way that although they are different in some ways, yet neither of them may be had without some part of the other, because the higher part of the active life is at the same time the lower part of the contemplative life. Because of this, a man may not be fully active unless he is partly contemplative, nor may he be fully contemplative, as it may be had here in this life, unless he is in part active. Well, this requires and merits some commentary in and of itself. It's a fantastic little sleight of hand. What he's first of all done is take his fourfold schematic and collapsed it into three, right? Like the three rings of Ballantine beer or whatever. So he's made higher active and lower contemplative part of the same ring, okay? We're going to see why in a minute. And then he goes on to say that you can't have one because they're joined that way in a ring, in a chain. You can't just do the thing that the church has polarized itself into doing for so long and say, I'm a contemplative, I'm an activist. Because if you want to live the full life of an activist, in other words, if you want to have both lower and higher active, remember that higher active is also lower contemplative, okay, in his map. So you just can't get the fulfillment of higher active without it already bringing you into lower contemplative. And in the same way, he says you can't, if you want to live the contemplative life fully, as it may be had here, in other words, having both higher contemplative and lower contemplative, then you've got to have some measure of active in you. Because remember, lower contemplative is always higher active. In other words, in that amazing sleight of hand, he absolutely collapses what has been a tremendously dysfunctional and hurtful dichotomy, which has dogged the fate particularly of the Catholic Church and the religious orders for 3 or 4 centuries. Am I an active order? Are we a contemplative order? And the sense that contemplative means living in seclusion with a pious inward lifestyle, and active means going out and shooting off your mouth all the time, it's collapsed it. He says they're a chain link, and they all imply the other. So in and of itself, I would present this schematic to you as something that's worth coming back to, because you always get tangled up with people who talk about the contemplative lifestyle and mean by that nothing more than a lot of inwardness and a lot of doing your centering prayer twice daily. That's not a contemplative lifestyle. That a fully contemplative lifestyle cannot, according to this map, ignore or neglect or override the requirement to touch base back into the world in that higher active capacity. And an active capacity can't have grown to full human maturity without determining, without incorporating some degree of what belongs and comes to fruition in the contemplative sphere. That making sense? It's a pretty cool map when you look at it this way. Now, what gets even more interesting then is, okay, so he's drawn this map, and what becomes the benchmark? He goes on to say, the lower part of the active life consists of good and honest bodily works of charity and mercy. The higher part of the active life and the lower part of the contemplative life lie in good spiritual meditations and consistent looking into, literally beholding, of a man's own wretchedness with sorrow and contrition, looking into the passion of Christ and his servants with pity and compassion, and into the wonderful gifts, kindness, and works of God in all of its creatures, both bodily and spiritual, with gratitude and praise. But the higher part of the contemplation, as it may be had here, hangs all wholly in this darkness and in this cloud of unknowing, with a love stirring and a blind beholding into the naked being of God himself only. And then I think I'll read the next right on through, because you need the both halves of it to put it together. In the lower part of the active life, a man is without himself and beneath himself. In the higher part of the active life and the lower part of the contemplative life, a man is within himself and even with himself. But in the higher part of the contemplative life, a man is above himself and under his God. So let's take a look at this and see if we can put it into modern terms. What is the benchmark? What happens? Let's go first of all to the lower active. The lower active consists of good and honest bodily works of charity and mercy. In other words, it's the basic ethical, moral life. Fulfilling your duties, showing up at church, paying your dues, applying the teachings as you can. But what enters at the next stage? Higher part of the active life and the lower part of the contemplative life lie in good spiritual meditations and consistent looking into man's own wretchedness and sorrow of contrition, into the passion of Christ, etc. What enters at this stage that wasn't there before? Pardon? Beholding, yeah. And do you notice the capacity for self-reflection? At this point, genuine introspection starts. That in the lower active, the person is a human doing more than a human being. You're out there, you're doing, you're occupied, you're moving on to the next thing. And in this next stage, what you begin to have, good spiritual meditations. And remember, meditations in the classic sense in Christianity means thinking about in a concrete, visualized way, reflecting on, and consistent looking into your own wretchedness with sorrow and contrition. In other words, the capacity for introspection, right? This self-reflective capacity. And looking in with the same way into the passion of Christ and his servants, the ability to add then to self-reflection, empathy. And then the prayer of praise and gratitude. So all of a sudden at this stage, what really defines this middle ground is the entry of the self-reflective capacity. And he uses that as the benchmark to divide the waters between that lower stage at the bottom, and as we're going to see, the upper stage, we're going to have to parse away what's going in there. But I think that many of us have a really clean taste of what goes on. I mean, we see this played out over and over again in our culture today. A good place where you can see in our own culture that sudden emergence of that higher active, lower contemplative is in the work of, say, AA. the recovery movements, it's the classic way of framing this, because, you know, somebody's all about doing, they're out in the world, they're doing their stuff, they're not thinking about it much, and all of a sudden, they hit the wall. They realize their life as it is has become unmanageable and have to turn it over to a higher power. And when you start working the steps, doesn't it sound an awful lot like what's going on here? That all of a sudden you have the capacity to make the moral inventory. You begin to look at the what is spirit for you and actively develop a relationship with it. So in the whole wonderful work of the recovery and in a paradigmatic way in AA, you see played out in our own culture exactly what's happening. And you watch how this works, because so many of the AA groups, for example, find their place in church basements. You know, and it's almost like instantly the church has got a mesoteric path. It's got a path that's actually beginning to change people's lives, to control their behavior. Because it's funny that you can have people playing by the rules at that lower active stage, but until they develop the self-reflective capacity, it's all external, you know, and it's very, very vulnerable, or AA wouldn't be that popular. You know, that if you're doing things just for entirely external reasons and have a very limited self-knowledge and don't even recognize the deeper states of anguish and the hidden agendas in you, you're vulnerable. And if you can't relieve the tension any other way, alcohol's a pretty good way to relieve it. So that's a beautiful thing. And I think that one of the reasons that the Thomas Keating's work has been brilliant and has had such a profound influence is that he's pitching centering prayer and the kind of purification of the unconsciousness right to the same place. I would say that if he's working the lower contemplative as opposed to the higher active. But you see, he's basically seeing centering prayer, he's reframed it in the very powerful teachings on the human condition and the divine therapy as a way of beginning to develop the capacity to become conscious of the hidden agendas, the false self programs, the emotional programs for happiness that are controlling and moving your behavior so that you constantly keep hitting the same brick wall. And he's pitched centering prayer and the whole path of work that goes in it as a brilliant transition point between higher active and lower contemplative, with a very strongly, I'm going to add, non-dual contemplative practice at the heart of it. But people for 20, 30 years now have worked his program faithfully for the acknowledgement of the false self, the allowing of that to be dismantled, sitting in God, sitting in the presence and centering prayer, and then moving actively to participate in one's own healing in whatever modes it needs. This is all, you know, this is all fine, higher active, lower contemplative stuff. But you see, it depends on and reflects on the self-reflective capacity. That's where the author, The Cloud of Unknowing, sets the baseline. When we can consciously reflect on ourselves, we wake up as human beings, okay? Until then, it's just going through the motions. So then what are we going to make of this other? The higher part of contemplation, as it may be had here, hangs all wholly. What a great medieval English alliterative phrase. Hangs all wholly in this darkness and in this cloud of unknowing, with a loving stirring and a blind beholding of the naked being of God himself. Well, we're going to have to come back and put some more words on our glossary list, like what's naked and what's blind and... But I think you get the drift that what he's done is described the modality of the exchange that goes on within the cloud of unknowing, right? all these words will put you, the higher part of contemplation hangs all wholly in this darkness and in this cloud. Remember what cloud equates to that diffuse awareness, okay? And with a loving stirring, in other words, with the engagement of this property of sympathetic resonance, the being able to feeling fully enter the insides of things, and a blind beholding into the naked being of God himself. In other words, not God as an object, but being able in some sense so that the deepest vibrational field of your own heart and the deepest vibrational field of the divine heart come into some mysterious entrainment, and there is an exchange. And it doesn't happen at the cognitive level. So if you want to say it this way, he says his map is a threefold map, which is pre-conscious, conscious, with conscious defined here as the capacity for self-reflection, and transconscious. Transconscious meaning that you're no longer being able to stand outside yourself and looking back at yourself as an object, which is the basis of self-reflection as we do it in the mature world. Something has transcended. You can't any more stand out there and say, oh, look at me, Cynthia. Let me see how I've done with my sins today. Well, I'm improving over three of them, but two of them are, you know, still got ahead of me. You can't do that anymore. Because the whole modality, when you come into this other way, you can't make yourself an object anymore. You can't split the playing field. That's not the program you're running. There's a deeper kind of coinciding and knowingness that goes on. So the shift into this higher contemplative, as he imagines it metaphorically, is simultaneously a shift into a whole new operating system of perception. Okay? So we come down then and take the second paragraph. In the lower part of the active life, a man is without himself and beneath himself. Why? Because selfhood in this map begins with a self-reflective capacity. So when you're just out there doing your, in a sense, less than what the real capacity of the human brain, heart, psyche is. In the higher part of the active life and the lower part of the contemplative life, a man is within himself and even with himself. Okay, so he's clearly seeing that he's within himself when he's able to wield the self-reflective capacity. And with himself, because with this capacity being wielded, you can be in relationship with yourself. You can love yourself. You can forgive yourself. You can do all these sort of things that are sort of basic motions of our whole wellness and recovery journey today. But it requires that self-reflective capacity. What's it mean to love yourself? You know, see how the setup is subject-object? Okay? And then in the contemplative life and in the higher active, but the higher part of the contemplative life, a man is above himself and under his God. Because you can't go back to that self-reflective place. Above himself he is because he intends to win by grace what he cannot come to by nature. That is to say, to be knit to God in spirit and in onehood of love and accordance of will. And that's a wonderful phrase, but I'm very struck with the fact that he doesn't anywhere use the word union. He's to be knit to God in spirit and in oneness of love and union of will. Because union is a word that assumes that two things that were different to begin with come together. Accordance is more a matter of alignment, that two things that might have been slightly out of sync flip into and entrain in one field. So the emphasis is entirely different. So what do we make of this? Well, I think one of the things we make of it here is that he's clearly identifying contemplation with this state, this third state in which we are above ourselves and with our God, in which that self-reflective proclivity has been transcended. In other words, the way he's describing contemplation in this book is, in my opinion, a dead ringer for how the current Eastern models describe non-dual consciousness, which sees no separation because it sees from no separation. And the irony of life at the reflective level is that separation is built into the part, into the whole texture of it, because we are using the mechanism of perception through separation. By standing outside of something and looking back on it, you separate from it. You know, by making things into subject and object, you separate it. And you separate it in order to perceive it. But a system that uses separation as its basic algorithm of perception is never going to be able to grasp unity, because it overrides the operating system. It's trying to do 9 in base 8. You can't do 9, you have to do 1-0. See, do you get what I mean? It's functionally impossible to reach that sense of unity, that fullness, that oneness of God, while still using the self-reflective mechanism whose genius is to set up the perception field so that you can perceive by differentiation. And the author of The Cloud of Unknowing gets this. But imagine trying to say this nowadays if you want to read through some of the difficult language of people like, you know, Francis Varela and the Dalai Lama and Dan Siegel and all these great John Kabat-Zinn, the great diagrammers of consciousness. Imagine trying to say that in the 14th century in a heavily dualized language that has shot through and through with Dionysian categories, in a language that's only 30 years old. Imagine trying to say that. Imagine, like, this guy is the Ken Wilber of his times, 6 centuries ahead of himself. And is it any wonder that he falters and grabs for metaphors that sought to convey? But what he is seeing is something very, very specific, and something that to our own day we don't see, that the lens of perception that the operating system we use to perceive reality is going to create its own limits to the field of vision. And that precisely what this guy has been looking at is that if you learn to hold your attention in a different way, so that you really can maintain and not lose energy out of that recollection, that field of diffuse awareness, it begins to create the basis where a new system becomes energetically possible inside you, where you can perceive without separating. And when that happens, it's a whole new ballpark. And to see that with great, great clarity, this 14th century author is already pointing our way towards this. So it's worth going back and having a second look. And the reason that he advocates for a while suspending practices, even practices that have carried you that far, he didn't mention Ignatian meditation because Ignatius hadn't been born yet. But it's a classic self-reflective practice. Most of the devotion of our church that we're formed in works at that level of higher active, lower contemplative. You know, most of the great disciplines you're used to, the examination of consciousness, the rosary as it's typically engaged in Catholic circles, where you're actually pondering the holy mysteries, the devotions at the foot of the cross, so much of that depends on and is pitched directly at the self-reflective capacity, intending to get it to move out of its smug self-satisfaction with itself and be moved by both greater self-knowledge and greater awe. And that practice is very, very good, and in its own time is worthwhile, because it begins to lay down those capacities of humility and of a proper sense of the scale of things. But as the author says, you can't keep using a practice which finally you've transcended. And the more you keep using practices that are based on the selfhood that's engendered by the use of that perception through differentiation program, the more you do that, the more you're going to be reliant on it, and the more your sense of selfhood is going to be thoroughly grounded in that. So where does this leave us? I think for what I'd like to really say, so as to leave time for questions here, is that we have now been working in centering prayer, some of us for 40 years. Contemplative outreach turned 30 a year or so ago, and it had already, you know, the practice was already well out there for before contemplative outreach ever got organized. So we've got like a 40-year track record of people who have been doing a practice, who, if my take on this is correct, has been through its kenotic practice and through its the letting go, the drop, the stabilization of objectless awareness, nanosecond by nanosecond, through all of these things, has actually been laying down in you the groundwork for running, if you want to use computer language, running the non-dual program. Okay? That because little by little you're developing those capacities for deepening heart stabilization, for letting go of thoughts, for coming down, and for being able to rest in the undivided energy field of an awareness that doesn't rely on objects. It's been teaching you to do this. And these things have certainly got an attitudinal aspect, and Thomas Keating has talked about that extensively, that as you live out of a centering prayer, you know, orientation in life, you ought to be moving in the direction of being more receptive, more flexible, more able to roll with the punches in life. You ought to be working with seeing places where you're stuck and frantic and frenetic and mechanical and working around them. That's the whole purification path. But you have to realize that you've been working with a path which lays down actual strong groundwork for non-dual perceptibility, not only as an attitude or as a lifestyle or as a philosophy, but as an essentially a neurological capacity within you. And my own take is that this whole great enlightenment, this whole great non-dual thing that everybody chases like a comet across the night skies, is physiologically impossible until the ground has been developed in you, okay? You can have states, you can have mystical experience out the wazoo, but you will always bring them back to that finite sense of self. Oh, I'm having a mystical experience. See how the self is reflecting on its own experience? As long as you're using that program, you'll be trapped in the experiencer dualism. So until you can move beyond that, you know, and until you have a stable neurological basis in you that can do it, as well as your practice, as well as your moral readiness, as long as your ethical readiness, until you have that physical grounding, you can't run it. You'll have mystical experiences. You'll live in the illuminative stage. Evelyn Underhill, in one of her more mordant moments, described that as the illuminative stage is basking like a pious tabby in the beams of uncreated light. But in the illuminative state, that sense of savoring my own experience of the divine life is really strong. So centering prayer, my wager is it has been creating quietly in all of us a capacity, a deeper capacity than you would think possible, to step noiselessly into that other sea. For me, what the real challenge facing contemplative outreach and practitioners of centering prayer in the next generation, what the real challenge is that our anthropology of transformation hasn't kept pace with it. You know, and that one of the things that Thomas Keating inadvertently threw into the mix with his definition of false self, for him, the false self was not the egoic self per se, but it was the wounded, automatic, damaged, homemade self in the grip of its emotional programs for happiness. And the teaching that has been such a cornerstone of contemplative work, and properly so here, has been the purification of the unconsciousness. The liberation of the self, the false self, you know, the dismantling of it, using Thomas's words, so that what may remain is the true self. But it's right here that things get very, very murky, and that I believe that the next generation of centering prayer people is going to have to tackle this head on and move through it. Because if the false self is seen as the wounded, dysfunctional, psychologically damaged self, it becomes all too easy to say that the true self is what happens when you've cleaned up your act. And so that often looks like replacing an incorrect and wounded and negative picture of yourself with a picture of yourself that has your real characteristics named. That I thought that I was I thought I was an accountant, and I discover I'm a mystic, you know. Whatever. But you see, you can't do that, because what you think, and what many, many people working in this in contemplative, you know, circles that have been launched here, they mistake what they think is the true self is really high egoic functioning. You know, yeah. You're still using that same perceptive mechanism, standing outside yourself and reflecting on yourself to generate yourself, to generate your sense. And even the language which you see, the contemplative journey, is specifically germane to consciousness at that higher active lower contemplative. I'm going on a journey. This is my progress. This is how I'm doing. See, the anthropology of it is still pitched to that higher active lower contemplative, to the finite self, generating itself by classic self-reflection. So we have this kind of funny anomaly here, which is actually a window of opportunity, that the practice which we've been given, which is really straight up non-dual practice, exceeds the anthropology that needs to tell us that the true self can never be derived by that separation program. The reason that you say you can never find your true self, that the ego can't inherit the true self, is not because the ego is incorrigibly sinful, but because the operating system is inherently self-referential. And it's only when you move beyond that conceptual trap that you begin to discover that you abide in your trueness But it never downloads into qualities and a track record and agendas and, you know, programs. They belong to the next level down. The author of The Cloud of Unknowing said in his other volume, pay attention not to what you are, but that you are. And what centering prayer has really prepared us to do, I believe, is to shift the center of selfhood into what's known in the great Eastern tradition as witnessing consciousness. The capacity to hold in an unbroken field, to not be so gall-dern interested in how you're doing and what your qualities are and if you're getting there and if God's speaking to you and all that stuff that's germane to egoic selfhood. It's preparing you to develop witnessing selfhood. But we don't yet have a teaching, a consistent body of teaching on par with the brilliance of the purification of the divine therapy to take us to this next step. And I think one of the crisis points is that we've frankly got a lot of people out there whose actual empirical experience in prayer has now exceeded the map. You know, why hang out purifying your false self till the cows come home? Why, you know, there's not an interest in who my true self is anymore. I mean, it seems like another data, because the true self, who am I? Am I going to make it? Am I getting evolved? These are all questions and fears that can be recognized as coming from that, from right out of that narrative program that's run as the operating system at that middle level. So as I close, I would just want to take a moment and signal out the profound work that this movement has done that has brought us so far. The profound giftedness of the practice of centering prayer itself, and the profound giftedness of Thomas Keating's creation of the whole divine therapy modality, which has allowed so many people to move from lower active into the beginnings of true contemplative awakening. And what's really needed now in the next generation is to simply go back to the stuff that's already implicit in the teaching and is well grounded in the practice, to begin to flesh out together a better anthropology of what this self is, who is above himself and under his God. And how that self moves in the world, not like an angel saying, I'm out of here, but as an inevitable, compassionate presence that moves forward along the Christic path towards a deeper and deeper embracing of the broken heart of humankind. So I lay that upon you as a challenge with my blessings. And we've got some time for some questions or comments. What we're going to do is to set up the microphone. Where's it going to go, Joseph? Okay, great. So we'll go to three with questions, and then we'll wrap it up. Okay, here comes somebody, looks like, yeah, just coming back. Charge! Yeah. Okay.
So we ran out of books, but okay. We have more.
Okay, good.
You can make that announcement.
We ran out of books, but we have more?
We have more of The Heart of Centering Prayer.
Oh.
Anyone was looking for that.
Okay, this announcement came, yeah, just right here. Announcement just came in. We temporarily ran out of books, but we have more of The Heart of Centering Prayer. So if you want to buy, go ahead and buy. Okay. Yes.
Okay. All right. Would you use the language of Ken Wilber when he says transcend and include as we go up, teal and beyond?
Mm-hmm.
If so, what are we including?
Mm-hmm.
And where does embodiment reside in that? Because
yeah.
of the potential beyond witness consciousness for greater awakening.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. She says, is this a transcendent include model? What transcendent include, which became was a very, very important datum in Ken Wilber's maps, and what it means is that we don't just slough off something that we've gone through and it's never seen again. That languaging that Thomas used around dismantling the false self was perhaps unfortunate and too violent. What we do is we transcend those parts of us that were broken and include them back into a higher whole. So the good part of that transcend and include language is that it's inclusive. Rather than setting up an atmosphere of inner warfare within yourself or inner spiritual chemotherapy, it actually allows you to become part of a whole. I think that where it falls short is the sense that the lower gets enfolded into the higher and is never seen again then as a discrete thing. And I don't think that's correct. My preferred image to transcend and include is an image of the bell rack. You know, sometimes in church where they'll have, in a big old medieval cathedral, they'll have four or five different bells and they'll ring bum, 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 bum. You know, one's real big, one's little. And they all get ringing at once. You know, you'll start with one and then you'll put the other one on. Pretty soon they're all hullabalooing and then they drop out and when there's one left. I think ourselves are like a bell rack. And I think each one of them contributes something to the harmony of our life. You know, that, and we need them all. I've been doing some work in my own kind of, I have a kind of four voices method of spiritual direction that's out there somewhere. But even that little false self, or as I call it, the nafs, the wounded thing, has got a valid perspective. And it's not false at all. I mean, empirically, it's probably your best and oldest friend. It's been with you for a long, long time. And I think each one of these, the egoic bell, we don't just transcend and we don't try and run our life driving down the freeway there in non-dual states. I mean, the egoic consciousness is extremely useful for putting the car in gear and getting things done. So for manifesting on this planet, having the agency and the clarity and the firmness that comes from a healthy ego, indispensable. And we couldn't serve, we couldn't transmit the compassion half as effectively, most of us, without having these here. So the idea is not just they just don't fold in and or disappear, but that from the deeper we go, you know, I would like to think that those bells, when you get the witnessing self in there, it's a deeper ground. And the other bells are held in that, and they reverberate in sympathetic vibration with the deepest part that you've managed to attain. But they all have their discrete individuality and beauty. So that what we are is not a folding back into an indistinguishable one, but as Teilhard de Chardin once famously said, it's a paroxysm of harmonized complexity. So that's my take. Okay. William. You're welcome.
One of the things I think you've said before.
Can you put that? Yep, you can pick it up or...
Yeah.
Boogie down. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think you've addressed this in your earlier writing, that a gift to us is that we want to come down into that place of oneness, kind of beyond self-reflection, but that we're not trying to get ourselves there, that the magnetism is that we're being called or invited there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a real important gift to me, because I'm hearing what you're sharing today is my egoic self now wants to turn this into another higher level of accomplishment. And so obviously that's not what you're saying, but I think you've made that really clear, and that is important to me, that I'm being called into this place and even drawn to it, not it's up to William or us mm-hmm. to try to get ourselves into that. So.
Exactly. Thank you. You know, that it's so important. I mean, one of the things that... that ought to be obvious, and yet it's the last piece we get, is that on this journey, God is for us, not against it. What benefit is it to God if we fail to evolve a seed that doesn't germinate? And sometimes when people go around and say, oh, contemplation is a gift, contemplation is a gift. Why would God withhold a gift? You know, what advantage is it? If you take, as I do, as really seriously the whole kind of extra-Quranic staying, talking about creation, why did creation come into being? God was a hidden treasure. God says, I was a hidden treasure, and I longed to be known. And so I created the worlds visible and invisible. And each one of us, I like to see as a pixel of God's yearning to be known. Each one of us carrying a trajectory of what love means, of what beauty means when it's carried in form. And as we truly live the gift of living our lives courageously, trustingly, and boldly, unfolding these gifts, it has nothing to do with we're taking our final exam and the ones that make A's get to go to heaven. It has to do with each one of us as we unfold, God unfolds in God's glory. And I'm not saying there that we're God. I'm not saying we're not God. But I'm saying that the whole universe in it, all its manifest tiny parts and bits and pieces, is like snow diamonds of what love can mean when it comes into form. So to live your life with that kind of courage and that kind of confidence, God wants you to evolve. And I'm using dualistic language there, but it expresses it best. There's no blockage. There's no resistance. Nobody's saying, no, you can't evolve because you're not worthy. Go for it. Go for it. Live it and share it. And the beauty of the heart of God will be well served. So you're quite right, Bill, that we've tended to take all this contemplative stuff and bring it back to so much of an individual basis. And enlightenment gets to be pitched so much, particularly in the West, like did you get your Eagle Scout yet? Are you enlightened? And as if the whole thing is I've got to crawl my way up and get enlightened, and then I can strut myself and people say, oh, she's a guru. What's wrong with this picture? You know, a model that's based on arrogance and exclusivity being used as the model of highest attainment. Stupid. It's what happens when you get Western contemplation mixing with categories that are not properly understood when we transport them into the East. We don't understand, many of us in the West, where the safety valves and the correctives are. So enlightenment can often just be seen as the highest stage, and with our Western achievement-oriented and basic competition, we go right for it. We want to be on the top. So staying closely grounded in our own tradition with kenosis, with humility, understood not as some sort of artificial posturing and groveling or a lack of inner force, but understood as the true condition of beginner's mind that allows you the flexibility to receive and give in this world. If you can take it that way, then we can go back and look at our Christian tradition from a lot of new standpoints and see that there actually was and still is a very, very strong teaching about how to till the ground of that finite self so that it grows from within it the beautiful full crop of the non-dual self. So. Yeah, okay, come on up. Yep, yeah. Yeah, you can all just make a line if you want.
Okay, right.
So my question is,
As we let go, mm-hmm. as in the cloud, as we let go of our training, mm-hmm. our ethical background, our ritualistic mm-hmm. experiences, mm-hmm. And as he says, you must let go of that mm-hmm. to reach mm-hmm. the lower contemplative, mm-hmm. Higher yeah, active yeah. lower mm-hmm. contemplative into yeah. the higher contemplative. You know, as a practicing Catholic and as a reverend of the Episcopal Church, once you let go of these things, can you re-embrace them with a greater and broader understanding and yet maintain your ritual experience, your rich ritual experience?
Yes, yeah. And that's a very important point, and I'm glad you raise it. Because, you see, one of the things that we have to always take into consideration is that there's really a different situation. The situation of the author in the cloud is he's speaking to somebody who's about to become a full-time inmate in a very rigorous silence-based monastery. And he's taking on contemplation as instilling a permanent frame of mind. Here, when we're working it with centering prayer, I'm saying that centering prayer encapsulates in it the heart and essence of what he saw in that teaching. And we do it for 20 minutes, twice a day, and we're not taking on walking around all day in that state of, you know, we'll let the state filter in as it does. But it never requires saying, you know, well, I don't have to go to church anymore. I don't have to maintain the churches. Let the churches die, you know, because it's a conveyor belt, again, as Ken Wilber used to say. And we need the outer religion, and we need the lower contemplative and the lower active and all of that stuff to get the thing going and to keep it alive. And when you reach the contemplative state, or what sometimes is called the esoteric dimension of the thing, what's the big surprise there is it's not arcane information. It's like T.S. Eliot calls it, coming around to where we were before and knowing the place for the first time. And so a person who has begun to stabilize non-dual, non-identified awareness can allow that light and that dynamism of love to flow through even the simplest liturgy. And you don't even have to change it so it's gender inclusive. You know, an angry gender inclusive liturgy can't hold a candle to an old patriarchally language liturgy that's being flowed through and held in love. And the mistake of thinking that we're going to fix things because we language them right or because we tinker with the externals, it's more kind of egoic fantasy. But yes, that we're, as the Oxfording pictures speak about, you know, once this, the weaning yourself from the practices, even for him, is for a period of time and to bust your identification with them so that you don't think that they're what's delivering. It's never them. It's what's behind them. And some of the people that really have pushed this all the way, like the Quakers, would say that even applies to the Eucharist. That whatever form we say is the ultimate becomes an idolatry. And once you know that, and once you know that all form is sort of the veils and the shapes and the shadows through which that which is always ineffable has to flow, then you don't get trapped in illusion, but still you can serve that flowing through with a newfound awe and humility. That speak to what you're saying? Okay, great. Don.
Yeah, thank you. I've been practicing centering prayer for about 10 years, primarily on my own until recently. We finally got a group on our side of town. And I've been reading The Cloud of Unknowing for about 20 years. So your book, the one we're using today, has been a great blessing to understand more about the cloud. My question is from my earlier days. Formation was a very good verse of scripture that was powerful to me about if any man, any person is in Christ, he's a new creation. Mm-hmm. The old has passed away and the new has come. So in the centering prayer thing, the false self, which you have helped me a lot today to know that that's not just the wounded self. I mean, mm-hmm. when you get that taken care of or mm-hmm. that the wounded self begins to be healed, that's still not the new
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Okay, but the new creation is in Christ. And somehow in my centering prayer, I don't know where the new self is going to come from. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's a good question or even a clear question, but what does that verse mean?
Let me take a stab at that. That I think that you're quite right that as long as you think of the new self as a thing, you're still going to be entrapping it within the gravitational field of that old small self way of thinking. So that practically speaking, in your experiences of that new creation, you're going to experience it as something you coincide with, something you taste, something you glimpse, not something you have or are. One of the great kind of debates that's gone on, and particularly in Trappist monasticism for a long, long time, is that true self when it comes, is that new creation, is it featureless or does it have characteristics? And there's a whole school of thought, and I think Thomas Merton was among them, that said that the true self was completely featureless. It was like when you peeled away the onion skin and you finally there was nothing left. It was pure of, meaning empty of, any distinguishing characteristics. My own take is that this is not so, but it takes a little bit that there are some things I believe that each soul has a signature vibration and that it lasts beyond this realm. It lasts out for a while into the, what's called in some of the inner maps, your imaginal realm. And it's exactly that's the basis of sainthood and praying to the saints as we understand it. You never mistake Mary Magdalene for Mary the Mother of God. They have distinctly different recognizable energies. So there's something of personhood contained at that kind of vibratory, fragrant, level that does have heft for a couple of realms out. I think at some point it does dissolve back into the whole and the separated consciousness returns, but not for a good long time. So yes, I think there is something there and that the new creation is not just a stripping away until there's nothing left. But I would say that we can't have it. There's a wonderful, wonderful passage in Jacob Burma in his in one of his early essays there in the Paulus series about the pearl of great price, and the seeker is talking to the pearl, talking with Sophia Wisdom about the pearl, and she says to him, "In this life you can glimpse it and taste it, but I can't let you have it or you'd mess it up." And it's true, because the moment that you think of it as something that you can grab and put in your hip pocket, your ego self has taken it right back over. So we have to just kind of take it that that's one of the operating difficulties of where we human beings live, right on the cusp between the infinite and the finite. But you'll taste it. You'll know without knowing. When you hit that vibrational current of your own aliveness, and it does become possible when sensation is deeply enough formed in you as a sensing unit to touch yourself from the inside as God touches, and without there being any kind of quality or name given to it, you'll know how you are sensed in the eyes and bosom of God.
Thank you for today. So I'm reminded of what you just said with D.T. Suzuki's book on Reflection of the Meister, Eckhart's theology, mm-hmm. this idea of emptiness, where it's not that you strip away everything, there's just emptiness, there's just no thing to grasp.
Yeah.
And he says, actually, emptiness is misunderstood in the West. He says, it's more like it's so full of everything that you can't grasp it. So that makes sense from a Western standpoint. But a lot of the points that you made today, I've seen in like particularly the Zen Buddhist tradition of points. And since they've been doing it for 2,500 years methodically, I'm wondering, you had the challenge of anthropology. Has there been any kind of insights that you've gleaned from that tradition that might correlate with at least a starting of a path in the West to see where they might find out. I wonder if you would share a couple of those.
Well, without getting too complicated here, I would just think that I think that Jesus and Mahayana Buddhism arose on the same wave, on the same leaping forward of consciousness into a sudden quantum leap understanding of what you might call, for lack of better words, bodhisattva consciousness, which is the realization that we live in a completely seamless, interdependent universe, and that everybody's salvation depends on everybody else's, and that there is no such thing as individual salvation because it tears the relational field. Jesus saw that. You know, it was seen certainly in the great teachings of Mahayana Buddhism. So I think they're essentially joined at the hip. I think Jesus's practice of non-clinging, which is clearly and demonstrably the core mechanism he uses in his teaching, and non-clinging as it's expressed in Buddhism, are very similar. The only thing that I would say is the difference, you might even challenge on the basis of what you just said there, that much of what I've experienced in the Buddhist pitches on non-clinging has to do with that you don't grab on the world because it's like grabbing cotton candy. All you wind up is with sticky fingers. That the world as it is has no substantial existence. And I think Jesus's take was different. That it does have substantial existence. And even though we live down here in a realm which may be dualistic and heavy and clunky and all, that it's still absolutely real. And it's working, its densities, its conditions are exactly as they need to be in order to express what it's supposed to be doing, which is to bring forth the energy of infinite love in finite form. So I think that Jesus takes a much more upbeat and proactive atmosphere. It's not because you don't cling, not because the world is not trustworthy or illusory, but because clinging immediately clouds the window of perception and throws you back into that perception of separation and scarcity, which is part and parcel of the small self turf. So I think they're singing their tunes to each other just like a Bach fugue. Okay? So thank you.
Thank you so much for today. It's just meant so much to me to hear you speak and all your poetic way of saying things and the images you use. And one thing that really struck me was how you had us do the chanting before we did our centering prayer. Mm-hmm. So my question refers to this. How do we really prepare ourselves body-wise to do centering prayer? Like today you did that and we could feel this vibrational energy, we're all sharing the entrainment. But how do we sort of, or maybe you can tell me what happens to your body when you're doing this? Do you interpret your sensations, not interpret it, you're not making meaning, but you are noticing. So mm-hmm. if you could speak
good.
To that.
Yes, good. It's another one of these very real questions as we take contemplation into the next generation. And I think that what we inherit our teaching and our teachers from has been the tail end of a tradition in Christianity that tended to be anti-materialistic, that tended to not be comfortable with the body, that tended to still use Platonic frames to think of spirituality as an escape from the body. And, you know, I think Thomas Keating's suggestion that the purpose in centering prayer, the goal is to make the body neutral, is perhaps said a little bit too weakly. I really love Eckhart Tolle's brilliant rejoinder in The Power of Now: nobody gets enlightened outside the body. You know, we don't go off into some sort of spiritual heaven and get enlightened. We're in our flesh. We're in, and so what the real question is how do we ask the body with all its wisdom to participate in sitting meditation and undergird us, and from the strength of its stable rootedness in earth and stardust and time from before time, how do we ask it to come along with the journey of the head and the heart to be here present? So I think we need, and we are already paying much more attention to embodiment as a new generation of practitioners move forward, making the body not only neutral, but positively in with the program. And the chanting is just because, again, there's been, from the traditions we've come from, too much of a cognitive interest. You know, the kind of practice, I have to say, that's dominated in contemplative outreach circles for nearly 40 years of reciting the Psalms in gender-inclusive versions drives me nuts, because it's still a little voice reciting a psalm. It changes nothing in the energy field. You know, it's more of the sense that comes to us from the tradition that it's all about cognition, that if you get the words right and the formulas right, anything's going to change. Uh-uh. What happens is that, you know, when you begin to get vibration going, not only do you embody, because music is made, you know, sound and tone are the two elements that God used to create the planet. You know, the intentional breath and tone. You're playing with the foundational cosmogonic elements, and they interpenetrate. Two stones can't occupy the same space, but two fragrances can. And so when we bring singing together, we fill the room with beauty, with a lack of cognitive content. We force us to come together as one, and we raise an energy field which is so vibrant in its own self that it tends to work very well to depress that tendency to think. I mean, people fall much quicker into entrainment when we've already entrained vocally. So one of the things we've been doing in our wisdom network is to try to create very simple chants, and we've tried a few of them with you today, that don't require music, that don't require musicianship, that can allow people to reach out across their seats around a room and put themselves together as one morphogenetic field vibrationally, and then we do our sitting. And I think that as we move into the next generation, we're going to see more and more awareness of the crucial importance of embodiment to carry our thing. After 2,000 years as an incarnational religion, theoretically, it's high time. So with that, I think, speaking of high time, we are past our end, and we got to get on with book signing. So are you going to wrap things up then, Roberta? All right, so I can hop down off this podium.
Oh, looky here. Oh, looky here. Is a southern thank you. when we do our introductory workshops, you know, the church will ask us, you know, would you come and do an introductory workshop? And they said, how many people should we invite, or how many people do you have to have? And I always say, we leave the guest list up to the Holy Spirit. Well, look who the Holy Spirit invited to come here today. Aren't you glad you came to hear Cynthia? And again, thank our co-sponsors here at St. Philip's. We want you to hang on for a little bit because we still have a few announcements. If you still want to visit Contemplative Outreach, our table over there, we have some events coming up. If you would like to have an introductory workshop to Centering Prayer, we have trained presenters, and we go through a special training to become presenters in order to keep the integrity of Centering Prayer. We have an event coming up next Saturday, which is a Saturday morning of silence for Lent, and that's at St. Aidan's in Dahlonega? No. Milton. And then also a five-day silent retreat, intensive retreat, coming up at the Monastery of the Holy Spirit out in Conyers. And the other thing is one of the pamphlets over there is about Centering Prayer itself, the method, some background information, and you're welcome to have that. So again, thank everybody for coming. And hold on for just a minute because we want Canon Zappa to come up and also give just a few announcements. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, thank you again. We're so grateful to Reverend Dr. Bourgeau for being here and for the opportunity to partner with Contemplative Outreach. Couple other thanks just for the Sexton staff who've been running around and cleaning up our trash and taking tables up and down, and so very grateful for their work. And for Brenda Fort, thank you. And we're also grateful to Brenda Forts, who provided our coffee, equally important. And a quick word of thanks to all the volunteers who came out today from both Contemplative Outreach and the Cathedral of St. Philip. Will you just raise your hands so that we can thank you? Thank you all for being here. Joseph on sound, we appreciate your being here. And there, we have a lot of things going on at the cathedral that we'd love to invite you to. Next week, there's a women's wellness retreat, Awake to Wellness. John Sweeney, author of the new biography of Phyllis Tickle, A Life, will be giving a lecture here on May 3rd. It's free, but we do request that you sign up either at the bookstore or online. Lots of other things. I invite you to just come to the website and see. The last announcement I wanted to make is about the book signing. So Cynthia staying to sign books. We had a brief run out. We ran out of books briefly, but we have them again, The Heart of Centering Prayer. You can get books outside in the hall. I ask you to line up. The line will start here at the table, and it will go this way in front of the stage and around the room. And we've done this a time or two, and we can do it pretty efficiently, I hope. So I invite you to come forward and just line up that way. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord.